How to Tell a Story and Others by Mark Twain. How to Tell a Story. The humorous story and American development. Its difference from comic and witty stories. I do not claim that I can tell a story as it ought to be told. I only claim to know how a story ought to be told, for I have been almost daily in the company of the most expert storytellers for many years. There are several kinds of stories, but only one difficult kind, the humorous. I will talk mainly about that one. The humorous story is American, the comic story is English, the witty story is French. The humorous story depends for its effect upon the manner of the telling, the comic story and the witty story upon the matter. The humorous story may be spun out to great length, and may wander around as much as it pleases, and arrive nowhere in particular. But the comic and witty stories must be brief, and end with a point. The humorous story bubbles gently along, the others burst. The humorous story is strictly a work of art, high and delicate art, and only an artist can tell it. But no art is necessary in telling the comic and the witty story. Anybody can do it. The art of telling a humorous story, understand, I mean by word of mouth, not print, was created in America, and has remained at home. The humorous story is told gravely. The teller does his best to conceal the fact that he even dimly suspects that there is anything funny about it. But the teller of the comic story tells you beforehand that it is one of the funniest things he has ever heard, then tells it with eager delight, and is the first person to laugh when he gets through. And sometimes, if he has had good success, he is so glad and happy that he will repeat the above it, and glance around from face to face, collecting applause, and then repeat it again. It is a pathetic thing to see. Very often, of course, the rambling and disjointed humorous story finishes with a nub, point, snapper, or whatever you like to call it. Then the listener must be alert, for in many cases the teller will divert attention from that nub by dropping it in a carefully casual and indifferent way, with the pretense that he does not know it is a nub. Artemus Ward used that trick a good deal. Then when the belated audience presently caught the joke, he would look up with innocent surprise, as if wondering what they had found to laugh at. Dan Setchell used it before him, Nye and Riley and others use it today. But the teller of the comic story does not slur the nub, he shouts it at you every time. And when he prints it, in England, France, Germany, and Italy, he italicizes it. Puts some whooping exclamation points after it, and sometimes explains it in a parenthesis. All of which is very depressing, and makes one want to renounce joking, and lead a better life. Let me set down an instance of the comic method, using an anecdote which has been popular all over the world for 1200 or 1500 years. The teller tells it in this way. The wounded soldier. In the course of a certain battle, a soldier whose leg had been shot off appealed to another soldier who was hurrying by to carry him to the rear, informing him at the same time of the loss which he had sustained. Whereupon the generous son of Mars, shouldering the unfortunate, proceeded to carry out his desire. The bullets and cannonballs were flying in all directions, and presently one of the latter took the wounded man's head off without, however, his deliverer being aware of it. In no long time he was hailed by an officer, who said, "Where are you going with that carcass?" "To the rear, sir, he's lost his leg." "His leg, forsooth?" responded the astonished officer. "You mean his head, you booby." Whereupon the soldier dispossessed himself of his burden, and stood looking down upon it in great perplexity. At length he said, "It is true, sir, just as you have said." Then after a pause he added, "But he told me it was his leg." ! Here the narrator bursts into explosion after explosion of thunderous hoarse laughter, repeating that nub from time to time through his gaspings and shriekings and suffocatings. It takes only a minute and a half to tell that in its comic story form, and isn't worth the telling after all. put into a humorous story form takes 10 minutes, and is about the funniest thing I have ever listened to as James Whitcomb Riley tells it. He tells it in the character of a dull-witted old farmer who has just heard it for the first time, thinks it is unspeakably funny, and is trying to repeat it to a neighbor. But he can't remember it, so he gets all mixed up, and wanders helplessly round and round, putting in tedious details that don't belong in the tale and only retard it, taking them out conscientiously, and putting in others that are just as useless, making minor mistakes now and then and stopping to correct them, and explain how he came to make them, remembering things which he forgot to put in their proper place and going back to put them in there, stopping his narrative a good while in order to try to recall the name of the soldier that was hurt, and finally remembering that the soldier's name was not mentioned, and remarking placidly that the name is of no real importance, anyway better, of course, if one knew it, but not essential, after all, and so on, and so on, and so on. The teller is innocent and happy, and pleased with himself, and has to stop every little while, to hold himself in and keep from laughing outright, and does hold in, but his body quakes in a jelly-like way with interior chuckles, and at the end of the 10 minutes the audience have laughed until they are exhausted, and the tears are running down their faces. The simplicity and innocence and sincerity and unconsciousness of the old farmer are perfectly simulated, and the result is a performance which is thoroughly charming and delicious. This is art and fine and beautiful, and only a master can compass it, but a machine could tell the other story. To string incongruities and absurdities together in a wandering, and sometimes purposeless way, and seem innocently unaware that they are absurdities, is the basis of the American art, if my position is correct. Another feature is the slurring of the point. A third is the dropping of a studied remark apparently without knowing it, as if one were thinking aloud. The fourth and last is the pause. Artemus Ward dealt in numbers 3 and 4 a good deal. He would begin to tell with great animation something which he seemed to think was wonderful, then lose confidence, and after an apparently absent-minded pause add an incongruous remark in a soliloquizing way, and that was the remark intended to explode the mind, and it did. For instance, he would say eagerly, excitedly, I once knew a man in New Zealand who hadn't a tooth in his head. Here his animation would die out. A silent reflective pause would follow, then he would say dreamily, and as if to himself, and yet that man could beat a drum better than any man I ever saw. The pause is an exceedingly important feature in any kind of story, and a frequently recurring feature too. It is a dainty thing, and delicate, and also uncertain and treacherous, for it must be exactly the right length, no more and no less, or it fails of its purpose and makes trouble. If the pause is too short, the impressive point is passed, and if too long, the audience have had time to divine that a surprise is intended, and then you can't surprise them, of course. On the platform I used to tell a Negro ghost story that had a pause in front of the snapper on the end, and that pause was the most important thing in the whole story. If I got it the right length precisely, I could spring the finishing ejaculation with effect enough to make some impressible girl deliver a startled little yelp and jump out of her seat, and that was what I was after. This story was called The Golden Arm, and was told in this fashion. You can practice with it yourself, and mind you look out for the pause, and get it right. The Golden Arm. Once upon a time there was a monstrous mean man, and he lived way out in the prairie all alone by hisself, except he had a wife. And bimaby she died, and he took and toted her way out die in the prairie and buried her. Well, as he had a golden arm all solid gold, from the shoulder down. He was powful mean, powful. And that night he couldn't sleep, gaze he want that golden arm so bad. When it come midnight he couldn't stand it no more, so he get up, he did, and took his lantern and shoved out through the storm and dug her up and got the golden arm, and he bent his head down gin the wind, and plowed and plowed and plowed through the snow. Then all on a sudden he stop, make a considerable pause here, and look startled, and take a listening attitude,
and say, "My land, what's that?" And he listen, and listen, and the wind, say,
"Set your teeth together, and imitate the wailing and wheezing sing-song of the wind,
bzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzz
a voice all mixed up in the wind, can't hardly tell them apart. BZZZZZZWHOGOTMYGOLDEN arm. ZZZZZZWHOGOTMYGOLDEN arm. You must begin to shiver violently now.
And he began to shiver and shake, and say, oh, my lan.
And the wind blow the lantern out, and the snow and sleet blow in his face and most choke him, and he start a blowin' knee deep towards home most dead. He so scared and pooty soon he hear the voice of Jin, and, pause, it is coming after him.
ZZZZZZZZZWHOGOTMYGOLDEN arm.
When he get to the pasture he hear the gin closer now, and a common back die in the dark and the storm, repeat the wind and the voice. When he get to the house he rush upstairs and jump in the bed and kiver up, head and ears, and lay da shiverin' and shakin', and then way out da he hear the gin, and a common, and bimaby he hear, pause, odd, listening attitude, pat, it's a-comin' upstairs. Then he hear the latch, and he know it's in the room. Then pooty soon he know it's a-standin' by the bed. Pause. Then he know it's a-bendin' down over him and he can't scarcely get his breath. Then he seem to feel some cold, right down most agin his head. Pause. Then the voice say, right at his ear, -HOGOTMYGOLDEN arm.
You must wail it out very plaintively and accusingly. Then you stare steadily and impressively into the face of the farthest gone auditor, a girl, preferably, and let that awe-inspiring pause begin to build itself in the deep hush. When it has reached exactly the right length, jump suddenly at that girl and yell, "You've got it!"
If you've got the pause right, she'll fetch a dear little yelp and spring right out of her shoes. But you must get the pause right. And you will find it the most troublesome, and aggravating and uncertain thing you ever undertook.
Mental telegraphy again, I have 3 or 4 curious incidents to tell about. They seem to come under the head of what I named mental telegraphy in a paper written 17 years ago, and published long afterwards.
The paper entitled Mental Telegraphy, which originally appeared in Harper's Magazine for December, 1893, is included in the volume entitled The American Claimant and Other Stories and Sketches.
Several years ago I made a campaign on the platform with Mr. George W. Cable. In Montreal we were honored with a reception. It began at 2 in the afternoon in a long drawing room in the Windsor Hotel. Mr. Cable and I stood at one end of this room, and the ladies and gentlemen entered it at the other end, crossed it at that end, then came up the long left-hand side, shook hands with us, said a word or two, and passed on, in the usual way. My sight is of the telescopic sort, and I presently recognized a familiar face among the throng of strangers drifting in at the distant door, and I said to myself, with surprise and high gratification, that is Mrs. R. I had forgotten that she was a Canadian. As he had been a great friend of mine in Carson City, Nevada, in the early days. I had not seen her, or heard of her for 20 years. I had not been thinking about her. There was nothing to suggest her to me, nothing to bring her to my mind. In fact, to me as he had long ago ceased to exist, and had disappeared from my consciousness. But I knew her instantly, and I saw her so clearly, that I was able to note some of the particulars of her dress, and did note them, and they remained in my mind. I was impatient for her to come. In the midst of the hand-shakings I snatched glimpses of her, and noted her progress with the slow-moving file across the end of the room. Then I saw her start up the side, and this gave me a full front view of her face. I saw her last when she was within 25 feet of me. For an hour I kept thinking she must still be in the room somewhere, and would come at last, but I was disappointed. When I arrived in the lecture hall that evening, someone said, "Colin, come into the waiting room. There's a friend of yours there who wants to see you. He will not be introduced. You are to do the recognizing without help if you can." I said to myself, "Colin, it is Mrs. R. Semicolon, I shan't have any trouble." There were perhaps 10 ladies present, all seated. In the midst of them was Mrs. R., as I had expected. She was dressed exactly as she was when I had seen her in the afternoon. I went forward, and shook hands with her, and called her by name, and said, "I knew you the moment you appeared at the reception this afternoon." She looked surprised, and said, "Colin, but I was not at the reception. I have just arrived from Quebec, and have not been in town an hour." It was my turn to be surprised now. I said, "Colin, I can't help it. I give you my word of honor that it is as I say. I saw you at the reception, and you were dressed precisely as you are now. When they told me a moment ago that I should find a friend in this room, your image rose before me, dress and all, just as I had seen you at the reception. Those are the facts. She was not at the reception at all, or anywhere near it, but I saw her there nevertheless, and most clearly and unmistakably. To that I could make oath. How is one to explain this? I was not thinking of her at the time, had not thought of her for years. But as he had been thinking of me, no doubt, did her thoughts flit through leaks of air to me, and bring with it that clear and pleasant vision of herself? I think so. That was and remains my sole experience in the matter of apparitions, I mean apparitions, that come when one is ostensibly awake. I could have been asleep for a moment, the apparition could have been the creature of a dream. Still, that is nothing to the point. The feature of interest is the happening of the thing just at that time, instead of at an earlier or later time, which is argument that its origin lay in thought transference. My next incident will be set aside by most persons as being merely a coincidence, I suppose. Years ago I used to think sometimes of making a lecturing trip through the Antipodes, and the borders of the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.